Welcome to another episode of the Chopped Liver Podcast. We are your hosts, Elise and Amay, and today we are joined by industrial and ceramic designer Sebastian Rivett-Karnack.
Welcome, Sebastian. We're so excited to have you on the podcast today, and we're really excited to learn about the world of design. This kind of area of design is something that Amay and I actually aren't familiar with at all. Like, we'll often have like our printmakers on and our art, like our quintessential like artists on, but not only are you our first kind of 3D designer, but you're also our first male guest. So we're really excited to have you here today and kind of learn about a form of creativity, like I said, that we're actually unfamiliar with.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a privilege to be here. Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about, you know, my background in industrial design and ceramic design. I think the easiest way for me to describe industrial design or 3D design is the facilitation of normally a client's view or a client's product or idea that they have in mind, and they don't have the technical expertise to communicate with the manufacturers on how they're actually going to make it, or they don't even know what processes they need to use. And then as an industrial designer, I facilitate that. We kind of often described as a jack of all trades and a master of none, because you kind of have to understand a lot of the industry and a lot of how everything works, but you don't have to know all the technical details. So it's good to know the industry as best as possible so that you can advise your clients as accurately as you can.
So that's quite interesting. I mean, do you physically make the things that you design? You're saying you don't need to know all the technical aspects necessarily, but do you physically make your designs?
Yeah, I chose to make all my designs. I mean, from the design point of view, you don't necessarily need to know everything about the manufacturing process, but I certainly found in my experience that it helps. It informs your designs a lot better. So when you do create a design, you don't have manufacturers tearing their hair out, you know, struggling with things which were easily resolved at the design phase. So I found personally, I like to make all my products. It allows me to test them. For me, the ethics and the design and the longevity of the design and how well it functions over its lifespan is incredibly important to me. So I like to make them and then test them before I even give them to anyone.
Is there a lot of testing involved in that?
Definitely. When you are striving for perfection, you end up remaking the same prototype often a number of times. I think it very, very seldom happens that I make a prototype and I'm perfectly happy with everything on the first shot. The difficulty in the industry when you're manufacturing products for other clients is that your prototype has to be perfect every single time. So you don't have the opportunity to refine. But when you're remaking your own products, I normally go through about 3 or 4 different versions where I'm refining. Normally the first one is to get an idea of what it's going to look like and what it's going to feel like, and to test the functionality, to test the stability. But then often you will find small little tweaks that you need to make. Most of the time it's for the manufacturing process, because you struggle to make something and you just don't want to ever make it like that again. So you want to fix that type of thing. And then you get to the last points where it's a really, really refining details. You know, what are the small little things that the client's going to notice on the packaging, you know, on the product labeling, you know, all the care packages that come with it, all that type of stuff.
It sounds like you can really like immerse yourself in this world of design, so many possibilities and things to be learning ongoing, which I think is very appealing. But if we can just backtrack a bit, where did you start your career as a designer? Did you go study or were you self-taught? And yeah, maybe what are your influences? What are the things that you're looking at in your youth that kind of drove you to this?
So yeah, I'll start, I guess, at the beginning. Makes the most sense. For me, it really, really started when I was a young teenager, I would say. My parents had a woodworking shop that no one really used, and I found myself very drawn to it. I was constantly making things. I feel there's a massive sort of sense of gratification when you make something yourself and then you use it. It's very, very rewarding. So it started at a very young age that I was making things, and then with BMXing and riding a lot of bikes and stuff like that, I had a lot of difficulties with the parts that were available to us that were very, very poorly made and very, very poorly designed, and it used to very much irk me. And I think that was kind of like the starting point for me of a design career, where I said to myself, I'm going to be a designer and I'm never, ever going to do this to a human being.
So kind of you.
I guess that's often, to me, associated with design. Graphic design is often what people kind of think of immediately. Well, I do anyway when I think design, but it's you kind of forget about the furniture design, the industrial design. You become a problem solver. You found something that you realize has to be fixed within like the world as a whole. It's having that initiative and that drive to actually resolve that problem in the most effective way for you personally, and then actually realizing, hey, this is actually going to be so useful for everyone.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, design for me is very much about problem solving. I think, you know, for industrial and product design, I kind of view it in two different categories. You have the designers who go the aesthetic route, who are much more about what the product looks like than how it functions. It's more the sort of designer furniture, the very, very high-end stuff. You don't really need to, on a table, necessarily need to reinvent anything. So you obviously have the flexibility that now is more about the aesthetic and how it looks. And then you have the more sort of, in my mind, the more sort of functional designers who are much more focused on how things work and how things are made. I think I've fallen into the latter category more than the first. Although I do very much like the way things look, for me, how it's made and how it functions is absolutely the priority. But I think you're right. Problem solving is, I think, how I describe myself as a human being, because I'm constantly just solving problems. I can't turn it off. Like you say, the book on the next to the bed, it's there because I might wake up in the middle of the night and I've solved something. And it has happened often that I just wake up and I've dreamt the solution to a problem.
That's why we need that magical notebook next to the bed. Because I feel like often as a creative person, you don't actually switch off your creative brain. Even if you're just sitting in the garden, you're like, oh, look at the colors, look at the birds. All this sensory information is constantly stimulating you. Even if you're not practically sitting and working or practically just problem solving then and there, but you're always being influenced. You might just see something. It's like, oh, okay, that, here's a silly example, like that door's squeaking. But you're always having that back and you're like, okay, there has to be a way for me to resolve this. This has to be a solution. And it's all about finding, I guess, solutions just to make your life easier, to kind of streamline everything that's happening.
And I think also, you know, for a few listeners that are not necessarily creatives, I think that for me is something that drives you towards being a creative, is actually acting on those impulses of, I need to solve this problem, I need to go find a solution, or I have influences, or you have an idea in the middle of the night, you're writing down that idea and you're acting on that impulse or that inspiration, and you're going and you're doing something with that, you know, just for those people who are wondering, because there are people that are just like, I'm not creative, I can't make anything functional, I can't, but that's actually all that it is. It's just acting on the thing that you've taken in or that you've responded to. So I think that's quite cool. Just the, not differences. I mean, I believe everyone is creative, but I think that if anyone wanted to be, you know, go into a certain field or an industry, it's really acting on those things that you're interested in. So what did you do before you started your own design business? You have a website now. Is that something that's new or is it?
That's very new. Yeah.
Okay. But you've been making furniture, you've been selling your products, you have your own business for a while now. So tell us a bit about that.
Cool. Well, I think I just need to continue in order, I guess. So after I was doing all the design as a child and the making as a child, it then got to that point where you're finishing school and you had to choose what you were going to do, and I knew exactly what I was going to do. So I applied immediately for industrial design in Johannesburg and Cape Town. I was accepted into both and then chose Johannesburg. And then I came up and I did my national diploma in industrial design. After the national diploma, I decided I would like to continue. I'd like to take it a little bit further. So I was looking at doing a BTEC. And then the opportunity to do ceramic design presented itself. It was the last 2 years before they were going to close, so I was able to just squeeze in a diploma in ceramic design. So I absolutely jumped at the opportunity to do that. And then from there, I then started my career working for a sheet metal company doing sort of high-end sheet metal design and manufacture, and I worked for them for a number of years. And then I left to start my own company. And then I started my own company, which was mainly facilitating artists in the realization of their products, sometimes their studios, which needed help in the making of the artwork, and sometimes in sculptures and stuff like that. So I would facilitate in that and made a lot of sort of artist draws and that type of thing, predominantly for the art industry. Then I worked for another company called Brush and Pistol, where we did high-end manufacturer of bespoke furniture, and I worked there running the factory for about 2 years, and now I've left to continue my vision, and I've just opened the website, which is very, very exciting. It's been a lot of work, and I'm very, very happy to see it finally come to life.
It's always so exciting when you get to see all the hard work just like exist on a website. I find that it's just, you're like, I did it, I've made it. Because I think so often, and it's, I would like to ask you, it's like, do you think now as a business owner, do you think it's so important to exist on an online platform and to have it as an e-commerce platform?
I think that if you're going to go try the brick and mortar route in this day and age, you're going to struggle. I think that if you don't have an online presence, you're shooting yourself in the foot. It definitely is the way to reach a larger audience. As the world gets smaller and smaller, as we get into touch with people more and more, it makes more sense to be able to reach a more niche market, but on a more global scale. What I specialize in making is specifically sustainable furniture and design and sustainable furniture. The South African market for it is obviously quite small. Sustainability is something that's quite new to design in South Africa, even though overseas it's quite a driving force. Still breaking into the market here. So I find if I can reach a larger market, it's definitely a lot better. And I mean, you can also imagine in the day and age that we're living in now, people just don't have the ability to move around as easy as they used to. And for something like this, it's perfect on a website. All the information you need is right there. And online shopping, I think, is just the way everything is going these days. So
it really comes down to something as basic as people need to be able to find you in some way. And, you know, we always say this to artists as well, is that, sure, you're an artist and you make work and all of that, but where are people going to see it? You know, and I think something like Instagram is very useful and we can learn a lot on Instagram, but it's so fleeting, it's so temporary and goes by so quickly, you know, and people don't always think to revisit. I mean, we know now to go to a certain Instagram if you want to check out something, but something as formal as a website could really provide a client or someone who's interested with that bulk information that you don't find on something like Instagram. Like, you could really have a beautiful description about all of your furniture pieces and their background, if that's, you know, something that's, or the sustainable materials and so on, just to give that in-depth information, which I feel sometimes just gets a little bit lost in Instagram. It's so perfect that they can supplement each other like that. So ultimately, in this big world or this little world, people have to be able to find you. So that's pretty amazing. And a lot of people are spending a lot of time online, and it's really competitive, I find, you know. So how do you promote your site? How do you let people know about, you know, what you do and your website?
No doubt. I mean, Instagram and social media is an extremely powerful tool in terms of feeding traffic into your website. There isn't really a more effective way of doing it. Instagram and being really good at it is something I'm not going to claim to be. I'm not very good at social media, but I do very much see the value in it. So we've been doing a lot of research and a lot of studying up on the correct sort of ways to do it. Me personally, as a designer and a manufacturer, when I'm looking at other people's web pages and their profiles and Instagram and stuff like that, I love to see it, but I want to know a bit more. I want to know where you're based. I want to know what your company ethos is. And you want to get just a little bit more reassurance that this is a legitimate company. The difficulty with Instagram is that you can make a company seem a lot bigger than what it really is. And there's a lot of people, you know, drop shipping and doing similar sort of things like this. And it can be very difficult to give a very honest and descriptive sort of grounding for your company without a website. So I think you need both personally. I think you can use anything in any tool that's available to you to feed information, to feed people to your website. But I think the website's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. I think you touched on such an important thing there, where it's like legitimizing it. Mm-hmm. Often when I go and I look for a company, or if I'm looking for anything, for example, say now I am looking for a company to cut sheet metal for me. I know I shouldn't, but I base my decision very heavily on how that website looks. When last was it updated? The type of graphics it's using? Just those general things. I know it's silly. I don't judge the book by its cover, I guess, but I can't help but do that, because that's so much your website and your presence online. It's exactly the same as like you standing in front of a group of people and being like, this is who I am. And you want to put your best foot forward, essentially. And I find that I like what you said there, was like legitimizing it. Even when I started my business, like the thing on the list was website, because how else are people going to find me? Sure, they can find me on Instagram, but where are they going to get that detail? Where they're going to get that nuanced information that gets lost in the ether of social media? But at least with a website, that information is concrete. It shows exactly who you are, what you stand for. And for me, it's also really important because as a person that, as everyone here uses websites often, I learned that what I want my website to have that I struggle to find on other websites. So it's like, I want my contact information just everywhere where people can see it, because my biggest pet peeve is going onto a website and I can't find your number. I want something as simple as your number and I just can't seem to find it. But I love your website. I really love the whole look and the feel of it. And I know that you also did your own photography for it. And it's so amazing to kind of see it all come together. And it's really fun. How did you find that creative process of building up your website, comparing, so that's more of a graphic design element rather than your industrial design element?
Firstly, thank you. I'm very, very glad for the feedback. I'm glad that you like it. Touching on what you said, I think brand security is really what it's about. Contact information being there or not being there is very much about brand security. If I see a website where there is no contact us, it immediately makes me feel anxious. So I think that a website is a very effective tool in creating good brand security. When you go and you buy from a reputable brand, you don't feel anxious about the quality. You don't feel anxious about if there's something wrong, what's going to happen. And I think that that's a very important part about creating a website and to create a brand identity for yourself where people feel safe and they feel that if they are going to buy your product that they're going to be looked after and they're not just going to be left out in the cold, or they're going to have an issue and then you're not going to answer or get back to them. So I think that that's what it's so effective for a website. In terms of the creating of the website, I found it an incredibly difficult but rewarding process. But certainly by no means a professional photographer, so there was a lot of learning going on. We took thousands of photographs to get a few good ones. I guess that's probably the norm, but for me it was quite an experience. I think it was amazing for me to create it because I had an idea in my mind of what I wanted the company to be, what it must look like, what it must feel like to a person. I'm trying to promote more than just a table or a item of furniture. I'm trying to promote a lifestyle and a way of living that's sustainable. So for me to be able to create something from the ground up with everything, from the color of the walls that we painted it to the plants that we chose to put in to, you know, augment and to, you know, kind of, you know, play off of the furniture, was a very, very rewarding process. And I think that the website, when it finally made it online, it was kind of how it looked in my head, which as a designer, I think happens less often than you would like to admit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a website like Wish can learn a lot from you, because that's like the worst website in the world in terms of legitimacy. We did stalk you on your website, and it's a very beautiful website. And I noticed that for the time being, there's mostly tables on the website. Are those tables made to order, or do you make in bulk, or how does it work?
So, I mean, we're very early on in the sort of building phase of the company. So at the moment, we have a lead time of 4 to 6 weeks. All the items are custom made to order. So if you order something, I will make it myself and make it to order. But the goal for the company is to have stock. That was the reason for the standardization of products. I've made thousands of products in my lifespan, but I've never made the same one twice, or very, very seldom made the same one twice. So I've standardized on a very, very small range of pilot. So they are all tables, and then we will have stock of them. So it will be the immediate satisfaction that customers need. So obviously, the age that we're living in, people want to be instantly satisfied. So people will be able to find it on the website, buy it, and then I will deliver it within the first week. Mm-hmm. But for the meantime, it's going to be 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, you know. Perfect. So you were also saying, you know, it's so interesting you're saying your process from actually riding your BMX and that not being as functional as you would like it to be, and tables, and you're mentioning that you make planches and you make objects for artists. And you know, how did that come about, your kind of direction in industrial design and focus on for artists, making things for artists?
It has no small part to do with my wife, Claudia, now Claudia Rivett-Karnak, and Chocolate Ink Studio. She has a lot of very strong contacts within the art industry, specifically the printmaking industry, and I immediately gravitated towards it. It's a very, very exciting, very vibrant industry, and I love dealing with artists. It's been a very good learning curve for me because it's a very, very creative field, and I'm in a slightly more intermediate field, I would say. But it's so inspirational. It really, really is. And through Claudia, I got in contact with one or two artists who said, hey, can you make me a draw? There's not many of these around, at least not at the size and quality that I'm looking for. So I made my first one for Nelson Makama, and then it kind of just took off from there.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, working at the gallery, obviously at Davikrit, and we have so many inquiries for people looking for planches. And I must say, it's not something that you could easily find. Like, if you just kind of, where do you find the planches? We have a few people, and I was very pleased to hear that you also make, because we get a lot of inquiries for this, and I'll definitely be sending people your details. But it's just so fascinating that that's just something that's not... Yeah, it's not. I mean, at least you built your own plan chest,
okay,
for example.
But like, my plan chest is nothing like the ones you build. Like, I think it was so both Claudia and Sebastian attended my marbling workshop, and Claudia mentioned to me Sebastian made Bevan De Wet's beautiful large plan chest, and I just went home the next day and I looked at mine. I was like, it's just not the same. Maybe I'm not built to be a carpenter, but it serves a function. And then I guess like one day when I grow up, I'll get a really beautiful. And I think that's why I love your plan chest so much. I guess just as an artist, we always just see plan chests and we're like, oh my word, it's because we understand how valuable they are as just a piece of furniture in a studio. What makes it even more exciting of the ones that I've seen you make and design is that they're these beautiful furniture objects. They're not just plan chests. But I think it's really exciting having something in your studio that a fellow creative made with such love and care and attention to detail. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've seen in all your designs is this immaculate attention to detail. Like, I think if anyone took like a microscope to that or just kind of really looking at it, I would never be able to find a fault. And I think that is so wonderful to see in any creative person's products or artworks or anything like that. The absolute love that you see going into these objects is amazing. Often, what I've always had to like tell clients is like, especially when you're making things to order, and the reason it takes 4 to 6 weeks is because it gives you the time and the energy to actually make a perfect object for you. It's not because you don't want, it's not because you want them to wait. It's because you're care so much about the things that you're making that you want to take the time to give them something that they will love as much as you do.
I don't think there's any higher compliment than that. I mean, thank you very much. I mean, what do they say? The gods in the details or the devils in the details? I don't know which one it is, but I definitely think there's something in the details. Making something right is very important to me. My company is called Sebastian River Karnak Pty. I put my name on every single product, and it's very important to me that the person has a good experience of the product. For me, when it came to the plan filing cabinets, the biggest difficulty was that they weren't designed for artists and that they were designed for architects. The grammage of the paper is a lot lower on any of the architectural stuff. You know, you're talking between 60 and 100 grams, and, you know, with artist paper, we're talking 300 upwards most of the time. So when you load a drawer completely full, it is extremely heavy, and that just was not designed in those plan filing cabinets. So that was my priority when I was designing those cabinets, is to try and make something that was very robust, that had a very, very simple mechanism that couldn't fail, so that artists would have a reliable product. And then the finishing of it, I would love to say that I designed it to be specifically beautiful. I think that that's more testament to the materials. I think that the form was very much dictated by its function, and that the attention to detail came in the finishing of the materials. And I think that if we chose the right materials, that, you know.
And I guess what you want, I always find that when you're designing something, or even when it comes to artworks, you want that medium itself to shine. It's similar in printmaking or in sculpture or anything like that. The material that you're using, I think, very much inspires the process, like you're saying, like form and function. And you want to use, like, for example, like specific woods that you're using. I mean, when I worked as a framer, that was a really important decision to make. It's like the quality of the wood, the color of the wood, how it's going to age over time. Those are all really important things to acknowledge. But I think it's also about I mean, we'll touch on it now, your interest in nature and sustainability. You want to celebrate those objects and those woods and the metals and all these wonderful materials. And I think it's going to be, it's sometimes in a waste if you're just going to powder coat it and be done with it. You know what I mean? But I think to celebrate those natural tones, and I think just adds this amazing elevation to it.
Yeah, I mean, it was the truth to materials, you know, from studying sort of fine arts movements and the art and crafts movements and William Morris. It kind of struck a note with me when I heard it the first time, that the truth to materials, that you mustn't ever, to make something look like it's something else, shows a certain amount of almost dishonesty, and that by simply being true to what it is and celebrating it, like you said, is for me when it works its best. Everything we make has an impact on our environment. As careful as we want to be, we have an impact. And it's for that reason I don't particularly like words like environmentally friendly, because I don't think anything we do as human beings is friendly to the environment. But it can be more sustainable. And I think that when you choose your materials based on criteria like durability and sustainability, you narrow down the materials that you can use a lot. But when you find one that works, like in my case, bamboo, it's a beautiful thing, and you can be very proud of every product that you make. And when you tell people about this product that you've made, you have the conviction, because you know that this is a good thing. For me, making it right, making it last, and making it out of sustainable materials is really the best that we can do as a designer, and to show integrity when we're designing things. Most of the time when we put a product out there, it's going to stay out there often longer than the lifespan of the designer. And I think that there's a lack of ethics in the choice of what we choose to make and what we choose not to make. And I think that that's, for me, been quite a focus.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, what I'm getting from you, which is just so admirable, I don't know if that's the correct word to use, but there's so much care in everything that you do, not just care for the materials and the products that you make, but also for the environment and actually the people using the products. Even if you're saying, you know, us as humans, we're not friendly to the earth, and we don't appreciate the things around us, but yet you're so caring about the people who are using your products. And I think that that's just comes through in your entire ethos of your practice. And that's just a comment on that is just such a very refreshing thing to hear and speak about. And everything that you're talking about is just, there's so much care in every little detail. And just funny enough, I saw on your website that there's a little tagline when you want to order a product, and it says, "Do you love entertaining as much as we do?" And I was just wondering if that's a passion of yours, or is that a client pickup line, or...
It's definitely a passion. I think for us, entertaining is something that we miss a lot, specifically at the moment. There's something about having people around and making good food and just celebrating each other and celebrating your friends and celebrating your family. So for us, I very much have this idea of this lifestyle, as I mentioned earlier, where it is a more natural lifestyle, where people live a slightly simpler lifestyle with maybe less involvement in technology. I think that people's obsession with communication has gone a little bit too far. I think that we over-communicate, and we find that we actually have stopped communicating with proper real communications with the people that really matter to us. We substituted with a much larger amount of less important communication.
Something that's so encouraging is actually to have this beautiful table where people can just gather and have a conversation, have a glass of wine or non-alcoholic drink, whatever your passion is. And I'm totally with you. Like, I feel so fatigued by all this digital communication, my phone, Instagram, all these things online, that I actually can't wait to escape to somewhere. It doesn't even have to be anywhere in particular, just at your home, where you're sitting around a table just with candlelight or in the sun and just having a conversation with someone and leaving your phone at the door, just throwing it in the ocean or whatever it is. I can't wait for the time where we can actually just communicate with each other face to face without worrying, without having to be so involved in our phones. And I think that's something that's just so irritating is that there's such an expectation for from people that you are available all the time, constantly. And that is just so, I'm getting so over it. Like, we don't want to be available. And people get like really cross when you're not responding straight away or getting back to an email straight away. And what's happened to society in the way where we're actually getting cross with each other for not being as invested in each other all the time, 100%. So just having this beautiful table, I can already see it, where you can gather and just have a moment of peace or silence or conversation is something also I really look forward to.
Yeah, I think our homes are becoming more important. I've always had that feeling that you get when you go to a hotel or a really nice resort. I've always wanted to bring that feeling home, that you can experience that every single day. And it doesn't necessarily have to be something that costs a huge amount of money. For me, with the cafe tables, it was that idea of a chilled out lounge or a nice cocktail bar or something like that. And to bring that feeling of sort of communication, the friendship aspect, the entertainment aspect, but then to bring it all home so that you can have something that's, you know, in your house. And I think I had the same approach with most of the products that I've done. For me, the desk was very much, I think, my flagship product. I've been working on it for about 6 years. I've made about 7 different prototypes of it, slowly refining the process to try get it as perfect as I humanly can. And for me, it was a home office. And what does a home office need to be for people? More and more people are working from home these days. And most of the stuff is quite austere. It's normally quite business orientated. And then if it's not business orientated, then it's quite residential. But there's nothing that really kind of blurs the line. So I wanted to make something that kind of made you feel like you were in a professional space when you're at home, but also not to feel like it was a cold or austere product, and that it had a warmth to it that would, you know, complement your home and make your home look nice as well. So, yeah.
And there's been such a rise in those like home office desks. Like, my Instagram sponsor feed is polluted with it. And I just keep thinking, like, I don't want this near my home. There's nothing warm about it. There's nothing inviting about it. I mean, you get those standing desks, but they look so clinical to me, and it makes me extremely uncomfortable. Like, I don't want to, I think white tables in general terrify me. There is no thought in the design of what that looks like in a home. I think a lot of the designs with these home office desks and furniture, they're essentially just taking your office and putting it in your home. But I feel like I don't want to pollute my home with that type of, I guess, for lack of a better word, like energy. I don't want my home to look like an office cubicle. And like you're saying, just trying to find the way to blur where I can still be productive and I can still do my Zoom meetings, but also in a space that I still feel like I'm comfortable. I'm at home. I'm in my safe place. And I think often what you forget is furniture really indicates how you're going to feel in that space. Like you're saying, like with your tables, like when you're sitting down at a dining room table, that type of design and how it functions, it's really going to kind of show how that evening's going to go, the type of table that you're sitting at. For example, at home, we have this massive oak table. I think it's been in our family for decades, but it's still, that to me is like, that table means family to me. It's this massive, heavy thing that I don't think will fit in any modern home. And I think often you don't realize how much furniture actually influences you in your daily life and how you interact in those spaces. And when you're sitting around a table or you're sitting at your work desk, how much that actually influences your day.
I think you said something beautiful there. I cannot see a round table without thinking of family. It was my upbringing. We had a round table. And the other thing which you mentioned was that it had been in your family for decades. And that's something which I think is also lost. I think that in this day and age, most people are going to own more than one of everything. The lifespans of products are typically quite short. There's, you know, planned obsolescence and lifespans, and that's a real thing. And if I can make a product that is aesthetically timeless, and I think it's not that difficult to do, so it's not part of a fad, it's not part of a trend, it's just a timeless design, that it will stay in a family for more than one generation. And in terms of impact, what better way to reduce your impact than to make it last longer? And I think there's not a lot of focus put on that any day. when I was at Varsity, I was told that planned obsolescence and lifespan is something that I will do in my career at some point, to which I answered, you clearly don't know me. Because for me, it symbolizes everything that's wrong with the design industry. I love the fact that a classic modern design from the Bauhaus looks modern today, and that if you bought something of extremely high quality, you would keep it in your family and you would cherish it, and it wouldn't be that that hand-me-down that you don't know what to do with. It would be that one that all the siblings are fighting over, you know, because it's just that important to the family. And I think that if we can bring that back into the design and just make things last, you know, like things used to be made, I think that we can reduce our impact a lot more than what people realize. I can make a product at the same cost to the environment, but if it lasts twice as long, I've reduced it by 50% already.
I think where it starts to blur is you'll often hear about fast fashion and the impact of that. But I think what gets overlooked is products in general. It's like you don't want to buy a new table every 10 years because it's fallen apart. Sure, it was cheap and you bought it from IKEA and it looks nice now, but the fact that you're going to kind of buy it over and over again, there's no sustainability in that. So I think what same time of how people may be approaching fashion now, it's like save up, buy that really nice coat, buy it from someone that you know has sourced that material ethically and has made that by hand with a lot of love and a care, and that money is going straight to feeding their family. Look, take that mindset that's, I think, a lot being pushed in media at the moment, but take that same mindset and push it into products. People that go to people that are making these by hand, where they kind of have their company that they're building up. Doesn't mean that you don't have to buy that cool thing from IKEA, but I think it's just kind of going back to what you're saying, it's just making different choices in your own designing, but also making choices in how you're purchasing products. And I think what's nice going back to the website is that all that information is there of how that is kind of sourced, how you're using it, what this product actually stands for. And I think it goes back to just clients and consumers doing the research and making sustainable choices. And I mean, that's literally happened where me and my siblings were joking around like, okay, who's taking what when mom and dad die? Let's start putting our names on things now so we don't argue later in life. But because those objects mean something. And I think we need to, as consumers, even though we're living in this extremely fast-paced world where we're constantly bombarded by office desks and standing desks and things like that, but go back to a form of simplicity of buying. Sure, that object that you're buying is going to cost more, but in the long term, it has so much more value, not only for sustainability, but value that you're bringing into your cultural home as well. And I think when we start to kind of shift our mindset and how we're purchasing products, and what's also wonderful is that we're shifting on kind of putting more value into the creative people and the designers that are creating these products. Sure, you have wonderful, very talented designers working for your big manufacturing companies. I won't take that away from them. But I think there's something very nuanced and special about kind of approaching someone like yourself and being like, listen, I want a very large table. I want a table that can fit 20 people comfortably because I love to entertain, I love to cook. And there's this wonderful collaborative conversation that happens in that, because me as a consumer really putting the trust and seeing the value in your craftsmanship. And then you get to have something that you get to pass down for decades and through generations. And it's like buying an artwork as well, I guess. Like you're seeing the value in that and you just get to have a really cool thing at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And so nice to have something to fight over, you know, where people don't, so many people don't do that. So it's nice that you and your siblings are having furniture and things to fight over. And yeah, in your own practice, you're very much an artist, you know, you have put so much care and so much love into your products. And it's interesting. I think we would like to know how that translates in your collaboration with artists, because, you know, artists' work is so personal and it's so it's very specific language. So how do you collaborate with artists as an artist yourself, and how do you guys find a way to work together, a language?
I think the first thing when dealing with artists is to take your own sort of personal investments and then kind of put them to the side. normally when I deal with artists, they have a very strong vision of what they want. So that's not an issue at all. They're very clear on what they want. It's normally the how are we going to make it? What are the limitations of materials? And I think the limitations of materials is probably the biggest one, because if anyone wants to push the limits of materials, it's going to be an artist. So in terms of dealing with artists, it's very much a sort of, like you say, it's a collaboration. So it's a bit of a backwards and forwards. I like to not influence the process too much in terms of its overall direction. I like to let the artist have complete control, and then I kind of just facilitate. And then when I feel like something is going a little bit to the part where it's going to fall over, or you simply can't make it anymore, then I step in and I kind of like put a bit of a dampener on things. Unfortunately, with design, it can be a bit of a dampener to a creative because there are limitations. There's limitations of process, there's limitations of materials. But normally the collaborative process is very, very, very easy and very enjoyable for me, at least.
That's wonderful. And actually what I'm noticing is that it's not such a big difference in how you work with artists as how a printmaker would work with artists like Claudia, your wife. And I just... I'm wondering, do you guys have quite a lot to talk about your different practices? Because the way you're working with artists is very similar to how a printmaker would work with an artist, actually putting so much of themselves aside and really dealing with what artists want, and also within reason. You know, you have to, that's really the role of a printmaker, is to guide them into what's possible, how they can achieve it. And yeah, and I'm just wondering like how that comes together in your family.
There's never a dull moment. I don't think we've ever been bored since we've met each other. There's so many things to talk about. There are so many parallels. I believe we spoke about it a little bit earlier, but I'll just touch on it again. I believe we were all born creative and we were educated out of it. I have found the most creative minds in people that have told me inequivocally that they are not a creative person, and that you will bounce an idea off and you will get a response or you'll get an insight that is extremely creative. My older brother is a software engineer, and you would be surprised at the parallels between the product design and the software design industry. There are so many things which are exactly the same. And for myself, the design and the art industry are obviously even closer to that. So I find that the studying of these is often what sets up a little bit of boundaries. But if you didn't study them and you had a bit more of an informal approach to it, you'll find that you can blur the lines very easy and you can move around between it. I would love to be an artist, but at some point in my upbringing, I told myself that I wasn't. And that's the constant thing which I have to constantly come back to and try to break down that wall that I built up. I think that creatives have a way of thinking that can kind of cross-pollinate very, very easily across industries, and that there's a lot more creativity out there than what we think. You know, I mean, even in fields such as math, there's an amazing amount of creativity. It's incredible.
But just on your saying that you know, didn't really see yourself as an artist, it's a comment that we often deal with, and I struggled with the same thing. And I think that, you know, I think that I would like to say to you that you very much are an artist. You know, just it's very obvious to me that you are, and that it's, you know, such a shame that in our minds we set up these boundaries for ourselves, you know, because everything that you do is very artistic. And I'm wondering if you draw out your, if you sketch out your designs, if that's a process that you follow. And if you do, then I never, ever want to hear that you're not an artist again, because, and if you don't as well, but I think you should give yourself a little bit of credit in that, and maybe just open your own mind to start accepting the fact that you are actually making something. And I think, you know, part of my struggle with artistry, or who's an artist and who's not an artist, has actually got a lot to deal with what we call ourselves. And my perception of artists in a way is actually what others call you. You can call yourself an artist if that's something you're directing as a profession, but you are still, I see you very much as an artist. So that's what you are. You can't convince me that you're not that. But it's how we associate that. And I think maybe very much you don't want to take that title in a way away from anyone who you admire as an artist, you know, but it's the different levels of artistry, which I think is just a thing to think about.
No, thank you. Guilty as charged, everything I do is sketched first. I'm very analog, so I like to sketch everything out on paper. resolve everything before I start getting into the 3D CAD and start modeling up everything. I think you're right when you say that when I say that I'm not an artist, a lot of it is just to do with respect for people who actually are artists. For me, just to do a doodle on a piece of paper and to call it a piece of art is not necessarily, for me, the same thing. I've often attempted, and I had an idea which I thought was going to be incredible, and I sat down and started sketching and lost hair throughout the process until I eventually abandoned it and said to myself, well, you're definitely not an artist, you're a designer, stick to what you're good at. But I think you're 100% right. I would love to see if people had a more informal approach to creativity. You don't need to study things in design specifically. I think that it helps. It gave me the framework to learn, but the learning is very much a personal thing. It's something that you do, and how motivated you are almost determines how far you're going to go in that field. I wish people would look at it a little bit less pigeonholed into boxes and a little bit less rigid in the framework of it, because I think that it's sad. It can be very sad. I went to FADA, which is the Faculty of Art, Design and Architecture, and their biggest brag was that they had all the different design disciplines under one roof. When I tried to move from industrial design to ceramic design, there was no facilitation for it. I had to start again basically at the beginning. I had to redo foundation courses that I'd already done because I hadn't had a person who had gone from industrial design to ceramic design. It had never happened. And I really questioned very strongly, how interdisciplinary is this if you are all very much in your individual departments and your individual mindsets? And that when I went from the industrial design to ceramic design, there was so much positivity that you could bring from the one field into the other, and so much positive cross-pollination that to not do it was almost like a mind-boggler for me. I couldn't understand it.
In the beginning of in our conversation, you said like a jack of all trades and a master of none. And I actually, I was listening to a podcast, but that's actually not the full quote. And I was mentioning it to Amay. The full quote is, a jack of all trades, a master of none, though oftentimes better than a master of one. So, and I think that is such a wonderful thing, because as we're discussing now, it's like there's such a cross-pollination. There's such design in the type of design that you're doing, whether it's through collaboration, it's through just having clients that just kind of want one-off pieces made, is that, sure, it exists in the realm of design, but it cross-pollinates into being an artist, being a collaborator, being a facilitator, and where that jack-of-all-trades thing just, it kind of funnels together into like this super creative person, you know, because it touches on so much. So that's always kind of when I always hear people say the jack of all trades is that, and I think it's as a creative person, you're constantly like, ooh, but there's that, and then there's that, but I want to know how to do that, and can I do that as well? And I think that's once again going back to like jumping on your impulses and your ideas that come up. And I think it's about pushing those boundaries, like you were saying. It's like, it doesn't have to be pigeonholed and being like, okay, I'm a designer, I have this one hat, this is the only hat I wear, but let's do ceramic. You know what I mean? There's, all because someone hasn't done it before doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it now. And I think that your approach to constantly breaking down those walls of what is design, what is sustainability, and what does that actually mean? What are these materials and the impact of that? And I think, once again, also just when you're collaborating with artists, like, because like you said, artists will look at a piece of metal and be like, can we do this, this, and this? And you're like, well, we can try. Hopes on high. But I think it's this constant breaking down of barriers and this constant rethinking, constant problem solving makes you very much that jack of all trades, but far better than a master of one, because you can touch on so many amazing things and bring so much impact to things that I think some people don't actually even notice. That's very cool.
Thank you.
So there's one thing that we haven't discussed, which is maybe at the final question. If just elaborate a bit more on your being a ceramic designer. You just said that you were crossing over between industrial and ceramic design. Like, what form does that take? And yeah, where can we see more of this?
So the ceramics is probably a bigger love for me than the design. My mother's a ceramist. and she didn't have the opportunity to formally study. So when the opportunity arose, she just said to me, please, you know, for me, like, do this. The ceramic for me is, there's something about that process that if you haven't experienced it, you have to experience it. It is such a, there's so much humility that goes into ceramics and making of it. I had a 70% reject rate for a year when I worked it out. And when I look back at that time, it was one of the best years of my life. I created so much work, and even though we had so much which landed in the bin, it was just such an amazing process, and it taught me so much humility. It taught me that when something goes wrong, do it again. Because ultimately, that's all there really is to it, you know, is that you just need to get it right. And often the pursuit of perfection is going to be a difficult one, and there are going to be failures, but you're going to learn more from those failures than you will learn from the successes. So for me, ceramics was is my passion. It really, really is. But I am not doing as much of it at the moment as I would like to. At this point, the focus is setting up the company. And then as soon as I can get the company set up, then I'm definitely going to be buying a kiln and getting some wheels.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, well, that's something definitely that we can look forward to then, and looking forward to inviting you back to speak a bit more about your practice as a ceramicist and, yeah, just how you're approaching that further.
But the last thing that we just kind of want to touch on is, part of our podcast, we have a doodle challenge, because once again, we really want people to, everyone's an artist, everyone's a creative, and even if you're just doodling, it's still like funneling that creativity. So we got inspiration from your beautiful tables. So this episode's doodle challenge is that we want all of our listeners to doodle what's on the table. And kind of see what comes of that. So please send us all your wonderful doodles. They can be in any form whatsoever, whether it is just on a napkin, can be on your phone, can be an Instagram story, just anything that kind of sparked your creativity while listening to this podcast. But Sebastian, thank you so much for talking to us. We learned so much about design and you, and I feel inspired.
Definitely. And make sure that everyone goes and visits your website, sebastianrivetconnect.co.za.
Yes.
And thank you so much for being with us. And really, we look forward to following what's happening on your website and, yeah, having you back on the show again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute privilege to be here.
And go buy a table.
Go buy a table. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
For more information on the platform, visit our website choppedliversociety.com and like us on Facebook and Instagram, and bring your friends.
And this podcast was produced by Jonathan Bell at Bell Studios in Johannesburg.